Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Yes, this is how it's gonna be. Yes, this is how it's gonna be between you and me, between you and me.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland and Nick Devlin? Y'all like Amy and Nick? Amy Garland and Nick Devlin's newest album is Hang a Light, which was released in June and showcases their bluegrass, blues, folk, and country influences. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Tonight's show is in partnership with the University of Arkansas at Little Rock's Department of Rhetoric and Writing. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark toured extensively with blues legend John So Blue Weston and can be heard on John's CDs, Blues at Daybreak and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock artist Stephanie Darnell with her mosaic windows, this one and this one over here, which are for sale. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and Stephanie at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our writers are all students in the Rhetoric and Writing Department at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and their stories revolve around changes. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Jasmine Williams sees a connection go up in smoke, and we'll end the night with Holland Callpleasure, a church camp, and a kiss. But let's start the night with Roger Doyne, as his change literally comes from the sky in A Day of Reckoning.
It was a beautiful afternoon when I stopped by to see Aunt Flo on the way home to continue working on my 7-year project. This was in College Station, Arkansas, March 1st, 1997. I called my house my 7-year project because I'd been working on it for 7 years, seemingly day and night. I worked many days before work. I worked after work. I worked during holidays while my family watched with amazement. Little did I know, on this day, a day of reckoning, my house, my life, and my town were about to be changed forever. Populated in the early 1900s by a handful of sharecroppers, College Station is a town on the outskirts of Little Rock of about 600 lower-income African-American citizens. My grandfather's family was one of the original settlers. The town had gained itself quite a reputation over the years. From the 60s through the 90s, the news was plastered with reports of shootings, killings, fights, drug busts, and every imaginable thing. A small strip called the Pike is where the notorious would spend their weekends carousing, drinking, partying, and much more than I choose to describe. This little area drew from all the other small towns in the southeast part of the city. Places like Granite Mountain, Sweet Home, Wrightsville, Higgins, and the notorious East End communities. You would not have to be a brain surgeon to figure out what would happen on Friday and Saturday nights when the overworked and underpaid get together in one condensed area, loaded with liquor, drugs, women, and guns. A dangerous combination. Needless to say, the city at large all knew about College Station, and it wasn't for reasons that you would want to write home to Mama about. Other than that small area of real estate called the Pike, College Station was no different than any other community in the South. Good, loving people that would give you the shirt off their back, a spanking when you needed it, and a good old plate of chitlins to eat as they sent you on your way home. However, the Pike, which was about half the size of a football field, held 600 citizens hostage every weekend while its participants parted and swayed to the loud sounds of Bobby Bland, B.B. King, Muddy Waters singing blues songs like The Thrill Is Gone and Got My Mojo Working. All of it was about to come to an end. Her name was Florine. We called her Aunt Flo. She was about 80 years old at the time and still a handful to deal with. She said, "Boy, you better get somewhere and turn that TV on and watch where those tornadoes are." I replied, "Aunt Flo, what you talking about? It is as calm as day outside." She just shook her head slowly and kept watching the TV. I sat down for a minute or so and watched the newscast. After a moment, I thought, I'd better get on up from here and get to the house. The sky was the bluest you'd ever hope to see. I wasn't aware that just on the other side of the tracks, death and destruction was just moments away. As I approached my house, I began to see sprinkles, and that concerned me. I'd never been in a tornado before, but what I've heard about them is that most of the time it is preceded by rain. As I entered the house, my wife, two daughters, and my mother were sitting on the couch with the TV off. I said to my wife as I passed them swiftly on my way to the bathroom, "Y'all better turn that TV on and find out where those tornadoes are," and I speedily went on to relieve myself. As I walked back into the front room, I was met in the doorway with screams as they ran past shouting, "It's here! Run! It's here!" In a second, I had to decide whether to just take their word for it or see it with my own eyes. With both amazement and fright, I decided I needed to have a look. As I entered the front room, I'll never forget the horror that I saw. The front wall of my house was lined with windows from one side to the next. Outside was completely dark. Those sprinkles of rain that I met on my way home earlier had now turned into a powerful storm beating against every inch of my house. I looked toward the front window wall and stopped. Glass from the windows was popping like popcorn as it was being ripped out of its socket like paper in the hands of a child. I thought, "Oh my God." As I quickly turned and joined my family in the bathroom. Well, joined is much too calm of a word. Actually, I ran and dove on top of them as we began to cry out to the Lord, "Help!" For about 30 seconds long, we listened as the tornado dismantled my 7-year project. Stick by stick, my house was being ripped apart, and we wondered whether we would make it out with our own lives. It finally quieted down. We peeked out the bathroom door to see if it was safe to come out. First thing we noticed was that we were still alive. Hallelujah. My wife, my children, and my mother all were okay. But the rest of it was not. The Suburban sitting outside my bedroom wall before the storm was now part of the wall. We walked through the house and back into the front room that we escaped out of earlier. It looked like a war scene. Every window in my perfect window wall was gone. The entire wall right next to the window wall, gone. The antique piano that I remember my grandmother sitting at with my daughter in her lap, gone. We leaped outside the house from the hole in the wall. Wires from the electrical poles laid across the house and yard, tree limbs, trunks, and debris plastered the ground. From the inside of the house, it seemed as though we did not suffer as much damage as I thought. I mean, all the walls except the front two seemed to be intact. The tornado had come and gone, and my project still stands. I was already envisioning putting it back together again. Once on the ground, my wife and I very carefully made our way across the house so that we could get a better perspective of what just happened. As we climbed over pianos, walls, trees, and wires, we both turned around and looked to see the state of my once prized possession. What we saw still rattles my cage to this day. The second story of my house was completely gone. I mean, completely gone. Upon discovering this shocking piece of revelation, both our hands flew up toward the heavens simultaneously, giving thanks and praise to our God for his goodness and his tremendous mercy upon us that day. Just one glance behind us would serve to prove why we were so grateful. Upon the tornado leaving my house, about 100 yards due north of us, a newly built community health center, in one big pounce, it totally destroyed that structure down to its very foundation. Now do you see why we lifted our hands toward the sky? Unfortunately, everyone in the community did not feel so blessed that day. Four individuals lost their lives. Several residents lost everything they owned. Some houses and businesses were totally destroyed, and the Pike decimated. This tornado drew national attention. Even our then President Clinton toured the community, hugged some necks, and shook some hands. He pledged not to forget us that day, and for that, we were most hopeful. This was the first day of March, 1997, the day of reckoning. Thank you.
Roger Doyne is a native of College Station, Arkansas. The husband of Regina Doyne of 20 years, they have six children, Elizabeth, Rebecca, Jessica, Emily, Derek Jr., and Caitlin. Roger is a senior professional and technical writing major with a double minor in nonprofit leadership studies and religious studies at UALR. Next, Jasmine Williams extends her hand after a loved one's major life change in On Standby.
It was cold outside. Not a freezing cold, but a slight chill. It was the kind of cold when the seasons are on the brink of change. The kind of cold that's not really cold, but it should be warmer for that time of year. The kind of cold begging to become springtime. He sat in the passenger seat, holding his phone to his ear. By the look on his face, I could tell that something bad had happened. I felt my husband. I sensed his emotions, and I just knew. I knew him. Like a doctor, I waited on standby, ready for the signal to go in and fix the problem. I was ready to hold him, prepared to scold the culprit. After he hung up the phone, he stared into space, a stare of emptiness, loss. "My grandmother's house burned down," he said with a dull voice. "I cannot fix this." I remember the slight breeze kissing my face. It was my first time leaving home after giving birth to our second child. We stopped for lunch. It was there that we heard in the drive-thru that was probably packed with cars, yet I can only remember it being empty. That restaurant was always packed, but my memory has made that day a day of emptiness. When my husband hung up the phone, he calmly explained what he knew. City workers doing renovations on the house had left a container of glue between the stove and water heater. The house burst into flames. Three workers were sent to the hospital with severe burns. They all survived. I was relieved that his grandmother had not been there and was in a safe place, alive. A neighborhood friend called us. The house was still burning, and the area had been barricaded by emergency crews. We managed to get about a block away from the house, not close enough to see what was happening, but enough to feel the heat and inhale the smoke. I watched my husband trek up the hill to the house while I sat in the car with our children. Family members spoke to us as they arrived and walked up the hill. I was worried. I knew my husband and what this house meant to him. I needed to be there for him, be his wife. Finally, he returned, to my surprise, well composed. "That house is done," he said. "It's gone." The house was still standing, but it was hollowed out by the fire. Now was my turn. I slowly left the car. The shutting door seemed to blare, almost deafening. Time slowed. My feet glided toward the house. The heat and smoke from the fire pulled me uphill. When I reached the top, I panicked. The family stood around watching the house being sprayed down and boarded up. I didn't know what to do or say, or if I was allowed to show emotion. If I cried, would they smirk at me? There was no way I could relate to their grief, to their pain. If I just stood there, would they know my purpose? Would I be a representative of the family, or was I just a bystander in shock? If I attempted to comfort them, would they feel as though I was simply playing a role? Did they understand that this house meant something to me too, even if my years of memories were only a dividend of theirs? I could hear my heartbeat strumming. A crown of sweat beads began to form on the top of my forehead. Smoke traveled into my nostrils and down my lungs. It was time to go. When I reached the car, my husband was on the phone telling distant family what had happened. Still calm, still composed, I did not know what to make of him. At any moment, I was prepared. I was waiting for the breakdown. At any moment, I was open, arms receiving, ready to embrace him and dry his tears. It did not happen. The ride home was silent. That night, we reminisced. The day I met his family, the day his grandmother interrogated me like a murder suspect, and the day that she showed that she really liked me after all. We spoke of times that would never be recreated, and all of the things probably lost in the fire. His prom picture that was thumbtacked to the wall in his old room, the coin collection he had been building, and other random items he packed in his suitcase when he moved from Virginia to Arkansas to help take care of his grandmother. We joked that his grandmother probably stashed money into her mattresses and had jars hidden within the walls filled with gold, diamonds, and things so valuable we probably wouldn't have known their worth if we had found them. But the real value was not in the house that burned. The value was in the story that lived. A story ingrained in achievements, failures, cherished moments, and broken promises depicting generations of lives. The house was a symbol of a mother forming her tribe. Grandma Veezy, they called her, had built that house herself, brick by brick. She and her eldest son had labored for it, broken their backs, ensuring its completion. Grandma Veezy was tough. She didn't take much mess, and she didn't have much patience. Tales have been told of days when she had shot at disrespectful young men with her rusted pistol or shotgun. She was a hard worker like her father, a former deputy sheriff, a legend of Hot Springs, Arkansas. So when she migrated to Little Rock, her reputation preceded her. She and her children ran the neighborhood, fed it, bathed it, and nurtured it like a nursing infant until it developed into a strong community of Black people. Her heritage was so embedded within those streets that a movement has circulated to name the street Veezy. The fight still continues, as does her history, regenerating itself once more as my husband and me established our first memories there. We can only envision what that house had once been. For now, all we could do was hope for what it would become. The next morning, Grandma Veezy's house was on the front page of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. People said that that day, her house and a nearby fire occupied all of the fire trucks in Little Rock. Months later, we learned that the house would only be rebuilt from the inside and the brick was to remain. Those same bricks that had been laid by Grandma Veezy herself were now stained by smoke and ashes, a bittersweet feeling. One Sunday, the family was called to the house to gather valuables. I remember that day as clearly as I remember that day in the drive-through. After church, we arrived to meet my husband's dad and aunt. My husband went into the house. We sat outside. His aunt spoke to me about her new ring and other things I don't remember. All that I could focus on was him, my husband. I felt him. I sensed his emotions, and I just knew. I knew that he was standing in his old room. He would look around at the black walls, search old pictures to see if he could make out any of them, and scavenge for a souvenir to hold on to like it was from his best vacation. And then, when he could see nothing but black, when he could make out none of the pictures, when he would touch the floor and feel ashes and gravel, that he would cry. He would collapse onto his knees in his best clothes, his church clothes, and cry. He would cry out for his grandmother, for his father, for those who lived there before him and held that place as a refuge. He would cry for the table where his grandmother sat in the morning demanding her cup of hot coffee, for her handmade decorations crafted over the years, for the sweet guitar she would still strum in the peak of the night. He would cry for those memories in those times. When he came out of the house, he held a few pictures and his coin collection. His clothes did not smell of smoke, nor were there smidgens of black. There were no tears on his face. He came out, smiling, happily clutching the items he had managed to find. "See, I told you he wouldn't cry," his dad said. My husband smiled. That night in bed, I held him close. And in the darkness of the night, I asked him, "Did you cry?" "Yes," he said. He knew what I was referring to. He felt me. He sensed my emotions. And he just knew. He knew me. Thank you.
Jasmine Williams is a second-year graduate student and graduate assistant composition teacher in the Rhetoric and Writing Department at UALR. She comes with a comical husband and three adorable mini Jasmines. In our final story of the night, Holland M. Colclasure finds a change different than the one he originally sought in Finding Jesus.
I was 13, Cherokee, red-faced in Hot Springs Village at Brook Hill Ranch, a Christian camp. One of the head counselors, Brian, was saying some prayer of thankfulness. I was the only person with open eyes, watching everyone conform to the dogmatic rules of prayer. Nope, I glazed others' eyes, seeing them tighten. Perhaps they thought Jesus could hear them better, the tighter their eyes became. I stared at their lips, trying to read them, to understand for what they were praying, if they were asking for anything at all, or if simply they were just moving their lips, in case counselors were expecting them, making sure they were being good Christians. I wondered if they were praying for the dying grandmother. I wondered if they were praying to be noticed, to make a friend. I wondered if they were praying for a kiss, to feel a bare breast against palm. I wondered if they prayed to get to the third base. I didn't understand prayer, the point, the act, the ridiculousness of talking to the son of an invisible man who is actually a ghost. I sat quietly and noticed Delaney from Baton Rouge. Her long blonde braids rested serenely against her chest. Her Louisiana skin smelled of honeysuckle and the slightest summer breeze. And I saw her sunset smile as I looked up from her thighs, and the guilt of surveying her body rested in the moment of visual contact. I tapped Brad on the knee and said, "That Delaney kid, she's smiling at me." He whispered, "Shut up, you're gonna get us in trouble." "Calm down, I'm gonna mouth the words olive juice," I told him. "Olive juice, what the hell?" "If you mouth it, it looks like I love you," I told him. "Oh, that's brilliant," he said with his eyes still closed. "Shut up, you're gonna get us in trouble." I looked at Delaney. I mouthed olive juice. Her smile matured to a luminous gleam against the newborn moonlight as the July stars stretched and peeked their heads from night's cloak, kissing the sun good day. "Amen," Brian said. "Amen," said the crowd. And I walked towards Delaney with my half-crooked smile. I ate a line drive at third base a month before, so I wore a bridge, basically two teeth attached to the end of a retainer. "Hiya, my name's Holland, like the country," I told her and stuck my hand out to be shaken. "I know who you are," she said and shook my hand. "My name's Delaney Coffee, like the drink." A calm, warm energy surged through my palm, up my forearm, and faded to my shoulder's top. "You have beautiful blue eyes," she said. "Thank you, so do you." I saw them sparkling when the moon shined, and you looked up, I told her. I was nervous. I wanted to tell her that I loved her. I wanted to tell her that I thought she was the most beautiful girl I had ever met. I wanted to tell her that when she smiled, I smiled, that probably the entire world felt her smile, felt her warmth, the radiant gorgeousness that she was. I wanted to tell her that she was the sun. I wanted to tell her how beautiful her legs were, how I watched them brown in the sun as she walked barefoot in the long blades of grass. I leaned closer. Her eyes glanced down for a moment of tenderness. She looked back up. Both of our blue eyes analyzed each other's readiness. And I placed my left hand gently against the back of her neck. The soft blonde hairs moist with night. Rested my right hand against her left cheek and pulled her against my chest for our first kiss together. Our lips touched, and I tasted the day's salt and a hint of spearmint as she opened her mouth slightly and glided her tongue gently across mine, grabbed both my cheeks, kissed me hard on the mouth. "You have the sweetest legs," I told her. "I love you too," she said, and smiled and turned toward the calling of her name. "I'll be right there." And our fingers pulled away. I watched her run into the dark as her brown legs faded into shadows. "Come on, let's get to the bunk," Brad said. All the guys were playing poker for candy and snacks, and I sat on the top bunk and started writing Delaney a letter. I grabbed a piece of beef jerky from the pack and took a bite. I immediately heard a snap and felt the hard porcelain as I bit down. I broke the two teeth from my bridge, and there was no escaping the gap left behind. "Oh, crap. Oh, crap," I said and felt gutted. My stomach bubbled, my hands sweated, my heart buried itself deep inside before embarrassment and humiliation settled. I felt like weeping. But I held back, so I told the bunk what happened. And they told me, "Don't worry about it. It's no big deal." But they didn't have to kiss anyone the next day, the last day of camp. I knew I couldn't kiss her goodbye looking like a rube. So I avoided Delaney all day, except for the few waves in passing. And after dinner, the carnival began and hayrides at dusk. I must have been the only camper not wanting to participate, but I found myself in the middle of the chaos. Delaney walked to me and asked, "Where have you been? Why haven't you talked to me?" I put my head down. And I whispered in ear, "I broke my fake teeth last night. And I felt embarrassed. I look like a hillbilly." She looked confused. "Let me see," she said. I stepped back, opened my mouth. She grabbed my hand. "Come on." We walked to the marriage booth and we got married 8 times with aluminum foil wedding bands. She held my hand and we walked around as whispers echoed and laughs followed, and she never made me feel ugly. And we sat there on that hayride and we were unruffled and we shared a kiss. And we kissed all night and laughed and sat holding each other until we were made to part. Before we returned to our small lives and our small towns, we gathered for the morning prayer and to say our goodbyes. I watched as white kids cried and their eyes welled in front of counselors. And I heard one kid say, "Thank you, I found Jesus this weekend." And he was weeping, and he looked to be in pain. Finding Jesus must have hurt. I didn't find Jesus that week, nor have I found him hiding today. What I found was Delaney's breast in my hand, and a summer warm hayride kiss that tasted of cheap strawberry lip gloss and the bubbleless zest of orange soda from a crinkled Dixie cup. And we sat together in our secret pact of summer love. And we found each other. We found our first kiss together. We found our last kiss together, and we found the true spirit residing in us, but it wasn't Jesus. Thank you.
Holland M. Kalklaser, a graduate student in the Rhetoric and Writing Department at UALR, is a Cherokee poet and author. His work can be found at Native Literature's Generations, and Holland is currently working on a short story collection titled There's Nobody Here But Us Indians. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to the Department of Rhetoric and Writing at UALR. Thank you to our live audience. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
From my very first favorite album called Favorite One.
Well, I took the time to know you, really know you and I took the time to show you, really show you. In the ocean, bathed in a love potion, had the notion that I took a ride into town, had to let my ear down, took a trip out to the sea, just the dolphins and me, and we were trying our fate. Each other's stands, sang songs too loud when the lights went out. Oh, but not a doubt, oh no, not a doubt that
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.